Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being until we ask for calls, or at least till after the half hour. With us right now on the line is Edward Klein. He's written a fascinating book, The Truth About Hillary. And I will tell you that as I opened the book and got started reading it, it really drew you into the book. It's really written in a fascinating manner. And Mr. Klein's a very, very skilled writer. He's written a number of bestsellers. But this book is different than all of the other books he's written. I read a book review in the Washington Post weekend edition recently, attacking, demonizing, belittling this book. Now, I'd read the book, and I knew there wasn't a word of truth in what they were saying, but pointing out, my goodness, you just used all this other information, just a rehash of everything in other people's books, and yet, of course, there's so much investigative effort here and first-hand interviews. In fact, I almost wondered whether the man who wrote that book review had even written Mr. Klein's book. But I'm going to let him tell you a little bit about what has happened to him since he wrote The Truth About Hillary. Ed, thank you so very much for being with us again.
Dr. Stan, thank you so much for having me on again.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what happened as far as all those scheduled interviews you had on nationwide television?
Well, I was booked, as they say, scheduled to go on several major television shows, Good Morning America, Chris Matthews, Hardball, Joe Scarborough, Paula Zahn, Aaron Brown, etc., until Hillary and her henchmen found out about it. And they called up these networks and made it very plain that Hillary would be very upset if they had me on, and that her upsetness might take the form of her being unavailable to these shows in the future. And so, faced with that kind of intimidation, they all canceled their appointed shows with me, and I was blacked out, entirely, completely blacked out by the major media.
So much for freedom of the press here in America. I would like to say, if you, freedom of the press means if you own the press, why, of course, you control what is printed. But be that as it may, Mr. Klein's doing a great job of getting this out through talk radio, and that's why we've had him on all of our other programs other than this one, because I want you to hear his story of the truth about Hillary. Now, certainly you actually had an opportunity to talk to an awful lot of people who really knew Hillary, and you know, an awful lot of the people that you know had even been her very close friends realized that she was quite a scoundrel. Isn't that true?
It is true. People who have worked with her in Arkansas and in Washington and even supported her at one point had to come to the conclusion, finally, that, as you put it, she is quite a scoundrel and cannot be trusted and is not at all sincere in what she says or how she presents herself.
And of course, one of the points you make in your book is that we can thank Monica Lewinsky for getting Hillary Clinton into the Senate and perhaps even into the White House. And when we get back from this coming break, I really want to cover that subject because I think it's so beautifully stated that Hillary was able to use the Monica Lewinsky scandal to advance her own political career. We'll be back here in just a moment with Ed Klein on The Truth About Hillary. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Ed Klein's with us. And Ed, why don't you tell the story about how Hillary was able to exploit the Monica Lewinsky scandal?
Well, it's very interesting that until the Monica Lewinsky scandal, Hillary was perceived, according to the public opinion polls, by most Americans as a cold, detached, rather frigid and unpopular first lady. However, as soon as the Monica Lewinsky scandal began to hit the press and Hillary portrayed herself as the poor, wronged wife and woman, her poll numbers started to go up, and she realized that by portraying herself as the victim, by taking that role, she was actually enhancing her political power. And so she played it to the hilt, in fact, even claiming at one point that she and the president, her husband, were estranged and were hardly talking to each other because she was so upset by what was going on. And the more upset she claimed to be, the higher her poll numbers went, and it became clear that she was using this whole scandal to set the stage for her run for the Senate in New York State.
Well, I think the interesting thing was the impression that she gave to the American people. Why, I had no idea. Bill had told me there was nothing to it. He denied this whole thing, and when I found out, oh, I felt so terrible. What's the truth?
Well, the truth is that it was Hillary herself who actually was responsible for hiring Monica Lewinsky. In the spring of 1996, she received a phone call from a major Democratic donor by the name of Walter Kay asking Hillary to please hire, as a favor, a friend of his daughter. And this girl's name was Monica Lewinsky. And Hillary called the Democratic National Committee and told them to hire Monica as a unpaid intern in the White House. When Monica showed up at the White House, she discovered that Hillary had long before then posted outside the Oval Office, where the president did his work, an aide of hers, a trusted aide, who served as a hall monitor.
You know, you hold that thought because we're going to bring the other stations on and I want them to hear this story. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening, Ed Klein, the book, The Truth About Hillary, and basically Ed is saying that the truth of the matter is that contrary to what the impression you got from the media and from Hillary Clinton herself about just being, oh, just so hurt to find out that Bill was cheating on her and that he had lied to her about this and he had told her that there was nothing between him and Monica Lewinsky and then she found out that he'd been lying. The truth of the matter was that it was Hillary who had actually hired Monica Lewinsky and, of course, when Monica arrives in the White House, she finds that there's a woman who works right outside the Oval Office who's known as Mother Superior. She's Hillary's woman. Hillary has placed her there to spy on the president and watch all of the women because Hillary knows about all of the women. She's not worried about all of the women. She's not worried about any of the infidelities. She just wants to make sure that none of this information gets out and embarrasses her. So pick up the story there. Mother Superior is right outside. Monica gets to the White House. She finds Mother Superior. What was her name?
Evelyn Lieberman.
Yeah, okay. Evelyn Lieberman is stationed right outside the Oval Office and watching everything going on inside.
Now, Evelyn and Hillary go back many, many years to the days when they both served on the very left wing Children's Defense Fund, and they had made common cause back then as far as very socialistic policies were concerned, and Hillary trusted Evelyn implicitly. Evelyn, getting now back to the spring of 1996 when Monica Lewinsky shows up at the White House, Evelyn informed Hillary of what was going on between President Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. She didn't know all the details, of course, but she certainly knew that Monica and the president were up to no good. And Hillary and Evelyn transferred Monica to the Pentagon. Now we flash forward 2 years, 1998, and the scandal, the Monica Lewinsky scandal, breaks in the press, and Hillary pretends that she doesn't know anything about it and that she believes her husband when he tells her that he did not have sex with that woman. She blames it on a right-wing, vast right-wing conspiracy. All of this is a lie. Hillary knew about it for 2 years, and it was a lie when she then later said that her husband confessed to her about it 8 months later, which was also, of course, not true, since she didn't need his confession. She knew all about it. And later, she compounded that lie a third time by saying that they were so estranged they were hardly talking to each other, when in fact, she was conducting all the meetings in the White House in his defense against the effort to impeach him.
And certainly they were coordinating this whole thing, and of course Hillary really was the organizer. She was the really driving force behind Bill, wasn't she?
Very much so. You know, Bill Clinton may strike some people as a kind of a warm, fuzzy guy, but he's a very undisciplined, warm, fuzzy guy. He is hardly the kind of focused manager that you need in the White House, and Hillary substituted for him in that role, and in fact was truly the de facto manager of the White House during the entire Clinton 8 years.
Now, of course, we hear lots of stories about the way she treated people in the White House that, you know, if you couldn't even walk down the hall if she was coming the opposite direction, you were never to make eye contact with her, even to acknowledge her, you know, or you'd have her wrath.
That's right. It was the rule in the White House never to look the First Lady in the eye. And she was considered to be a horrible person to work for among both the private family staff, the staff that took care of the first family, and also among the Secret Service staff, which was detailed to provide protection for the first family. She mistreated all of these people terribly, and they resented her in a deep an abiding way.
And so I'm sure that some of them were quite willing to talk to you just about what they had witnessed and what they'd had to live through, because from some of the stories that you tell, they really have to be first-hand accounts.
They are first-hand accounts, and naturally they can't go on the record because they can't use their names, but I had a chance to double and triple-check their stories, and all of them turned out to be true.
And that's really what's so amazing about the book review that the Washington Post put in, because it inferred that there was nothing new in this story at all. It was just a rehash of the books written by Barbara Olson and by so many other people. And it's really just not true. It's a fascinating book and fascinating insight. So let's go back to the very beginning. And, of course, you have a lot in there about Hillary as a little girl and growing up and then, of course, meeting Bill. Why did you tell that? And how, you know, she actually almost got Bill out of politics because she wouldn't even take his name. She wouldn't shave her legs. She wouldn't do anything that was ladylike at all. In fact, she was such an ardent feminist, she almost ruined his career back in the 1980s.
Well, that's all very true. You know, Hillary arrived in Arkansas in 1974 as Bill's fiance, and Bill's mother took one look at her, Bill Clinton's mother, and said, well, you can't be serious. You're not going to marry this woman. I mean, Hillary was quite a sight to behold in those days. Wore Coke bottle glasses, granny dresses, thick black stockings, did not shave under her arms, as you say, did not shampoo her hair, and used the most foul language. I mean, she was much more than a tomboy. She was
an ardent feminist, would that be a
I would say she was a radical feminist who had adopted many of the lesbian ways. And Mrs. Kelly, that was the name of Bill Clinton's mother, she's her married name, said, "You can't be serious." And Bill Clinton turned to his mother and said, "Look, I'm not interested in marrying some Miss America type. I'm interested in somebody who will help me in my political career. And this woman is going to help me become president." That was his goal back then. In fact, it was the deal between Bill Clinton and Hillary that their mutual ambition would feed on each other, and she would aid him in his quest for the presidency, and then she would follow him in his footsteps after he had his chance.
And what we're talking about, you know, 1974, and this is long-term planning. This is, what, 30 years ago. And yet, of course, Hillary is drawing very, very close to the presidency herself. Now, she refused, as I mentioned earlier, to, and of course, for our listeners out there, I don't know any of these things. I just read Ed Klein's book, and fascinating. But Hillary would not use his name. She was Hillary Rodham. She wasn't Hillary Rodham Clinton. I mean, most wives take their husband's name, but not Hillary.
Well, this became this wouldn't be such a big deal if it hadn't practically ruined Bill Clinton's career. He ran for governor in 1978, and in those days, the governorship only lasted 2 years, so you had to run every 2 years. They've since changed that to every 4 years. So he was up for re-election in 1980, and it became quickly apparent that he was losing the election, largely because the people of Arkansas resented the fact that, one, Hillary refused to take his name, two, that she had what appeared to be a totally independent lifestyle, and three, because of many rumors that were swirling around in those days, 1978, that she might be a lesbian. So Bill Clinton's campaign manager came to him and said, I'm sorry, came to her and said, Hillary, you've got to do something about these rumors, these lesbian rumors. You've got to, you know, squash them and tell people that you're not a lesbian. And Hillary said, in words that I cannot use on the family radio station, she refused to do it. She refused to deny these rumors. As a result, Bill Clinton lost his re-election campaign. It was widely believed that it was due to Hillary that he lost. And she herself wondered whether she had made her bed, as it were, her deal, her Faustian bargain with a loser, because at that point Bill Clinton wondered whether he was going to go ahead and continue in politics. And it was Hillary who really more or less told him that if he didn't, all bets were off. So she put the steel in his spine, and she emerged in public and announced that she was going to take his name. From then forward, she'd be known as Hillary Clinton. And she cleaned up her act, shaved her underarms, and acted in a much more traditional feminine way.
And so this then allayed a lot of the rumors that were circulating, and she certainly got her contact lenses, and she began to look like a woman, and people sort of forgot the radical things that she really stood for, her feminism, and we're going to get a lot more of this when we get back. Our guest this evening is Ed Klein, the book The Truth About Hillary. Why is this important? Why? Because Hillary Clinton may become the next president of the United States, and bring God's judgment on our nation. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this evening, Ed Klein, the book, The Truth About Hillary, and of course, Bill Clinton wins the election, he now gets to be governor again there, and this then begins moving him towards becoming the President of the United States, and so Hillary then continues working with him. But what about Vince Foster? We always heard, I've talked to a number of the state patrol officers who were assigned to Clinton there in the state house in Arkansas. Many people believe that there was some sort of an illicit love affair between Hillary and Vince Foster.
It was an open secret in Little Rock among the state troopers as well as among Hillary's closest friends, Hillary and Bill's closest friends, that she was carrying on with Vince Foster. That was the assumption. It was also the assumption that this was a rather strange alliance, since Hillary didn't seem to have much interest in having sex with either men or women, for that matter. And the smart money decided that there must be some reason why Hillary was keeping Vince on the string. And he was clearly smitten with her. Was in love with her, even though he was married. Marriage was not doing well. And she, on the other hand, had only one interest, which, of course, was her political career and Bill's political career. But Vince Foster was very useful. He was essentially Bill Clinton's enforcer in Arkansas. He would go around telling people what the governor expected them to do, and if they didn't, what consequences would be. It is my view and the view of other people that Vince Foster and Hillary had this relationship largely in order to keep Vince doing Hillary's bidding on behalf of Bill, not because she was in love with him or any kind of emotional attachment.
In other words, she used people. This was the way she functioned all of her life. She used him and used others. But what about the strange death of Vince Foster? Do you have any thoughts at all about that?
Well, a lot of people have asked me, do I think he committed suicide, or do I think he was murdered, or do I know? And the answer to that question is, quite frankly, I just don't know. Clearly, there are a lot of very suspicious circumstances surrounding his death, which would lead one to believe that the version of his death that we've gotten, that he simply went off to the park and shot himself, isn't an adequate explanation. Exactly what happened, I don't know, but I do know that there are a lot of suspicious stories surrounding this death. Certainly, Vince Foster was keeping a lot of secrets that Hillary was afraid would get out. And after his death, she assigned two or three of her closest aides in the White House to seal off that Vince Foster's office while they cleansed the office of all incriminating materials.
And, of course, the question is, if there is nothing to hide, why were they willing to violate the law? What they were doing, it was a police investigation, and they certainly couldn't control a police investigation, but they wouldn't even let the police in until they'd finished. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Ed Klein. His book, The Truth About Hillary, and we were talking about Vince Foster, his strange death, and, of course, Mr. Klein says, quite frankly, he doesn't know. All he does know, and he brings out in the book, is that Hillary assigned some of her closest associates to go down to Vince Foster's office after he had been found dead in the park, and, of course, remove any sort of incriminating evidence or any information from there, which is a violation of the law and a violation of the police protocol, and they wouldn't let anybody in the office until they'd gotten all of their private papers out of there. Now, The question is, what sort of things were they trying to hide? Was it having to do with Whitewater? Did it have to do with the fact that Bill Clinton had been involved with this selling of blood, infected blood, from prisoners in Arkansas to up in Canada, where they had infected some 1,100 hemophiliacs who subsequently died, and a lot of people up in Canada getting this infected blood out of the prison system in Arkansas that Bill Clinton was involved in, contracted HIV disease, and of course all these hemophiliacs died. Go ahead.
Well, there's that, Dr. Stan. There's also stories of illegal cocaine running in Arkansas under the Clinton administration then, when Bill Clinton was the governor of Arkansas. There are stories of intimidation of Bill Clinton's the women he slept with, threats against them, all kinds of cases of illegal, unethical, and shameful activity that Vince Foster knew about and protected Hillary from the public from knowing.
So, I mean, there were just so many things there, it's very difficult to put your finger on any one single issue. But whatever it was, once Vince Foster was dead, why, of course, all of his records sort of mysteriously disappeared, and they were never seen again, were they?
That's right. They're never seen again. We don't know exactly what was taken out of that office. And what is more amazing is that that office was sealed off for 2 days so that the police could not go in, and nobody ever accused nobody ever brought the First Lady up for obstruction of justice, which it clearly was a case of, and that's a criminal offense.
Well, it seems that some people can get away with criminal activity and others can't. Now, somebody had called in, and obviously they don't like your book. They wanted to know why you wrote the book and whether you're a right-wing fanatic or a Bush supporter. So why did you write the book, and are you a right-wing or a Bush supporter?
Well, I do like President Bush, yes, I must say I do. But that's not the reason I wrote the book. I mean, President Bush is not going to be running for re-election in 2008 when Hillary is running for president. I wrote the book for a very simple reason. I was looking for a fascinating person to write about. And I started the book with no political agenda. I wasn't put up to it by anybody. I've been a journalist for 40 years. I've been the foreign editor of Newsweek and the editor-in-chief of the New York Times Magazine. So I'm a well-known, highly regarded journalist in my field. And it was a question of finding a great subject to write about. But in the 3 years that I spent researching the book and the 96 people I interviewed, after I had gotten my notes together, I concluded that this was a woman who should not get anywhere near the White House. It would be a national disaster if she did. So, in my conclusions, I certainly am a partisan.
All right, and so you're not necessarily supporting the Republican candidate, but you're certainly against Hillary Clinton for the next president of the United States.
That's correct.
All right. Well, now, what about her association with Jean Houston and wanting to conjure up the spirit of Eleanor Roosevelt? You didn't go into that a great deal, but you did touch on that in the book. That really is very much concern to me, that why would anybody really want to begin to communicate with Eleanor Roosevelt, who's long since dead?
Very good question. And we would have to be in the room when Hillary was having her seances and channeling Eleanor Roosevelt to answer that question.
All right. So, but at least you touch on that in the book, although don't go into it in anywhere near the depth that other people do. But I do believe this is a very important issue. Do you really want somebody in the White House who is channeling dead spirits, or bringing in June Houston to channel dead spirits of Eleanor Roosevelt and Mahatma Gandhi? We're going to be back here in just a moment. Our guest is Ed Klein. His book, The Truth About Hillary, and if it's all right with Ed, we'll invite your calls here at Radio Liberty, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening, Ed Klein. We're talking about his book, The Truth About Hillary. And it's a fascinating read. It's very readable. It's, you know, and I wouldn't know that after having read the book review in the Washington Post, but with so many of the book reviews, it was simply a hatchet job. And I suggest you read the book and decide for yourself. Let me read this. She's the most unbelievable actress I've ever met, said a woman who worked on Hillary's Senate campaign. I remember one time at a women's leadership forum event in New York, 30 of us sat around Hillary talking about politics, and she said, "You know, I love this organization, not just because we sit around and talk about politics, because of the bonds of friendship forming around us." The way she said it, people were riveted by her performance, but I had gotten to know her, and I could tell she didn't mean it. She has this unbelievable ability to be a liar. She is soulless. That's a pretty powerful statement.
It's a very powerful statement, and particularly since it comes from a woman who actually worked with Hillary and helped her raise funds for her Senate campaign, and then who later regretted having done so. It's as a woman who is still a Democrat and still raising funds for Democrats, but she has, her eyes have been opened about Hillary Clinton. Call her soulless is the equivalent of calling her evil, and I think that's a very apt description.
Well, that's the sort of description you might hear from our programs, because we talk a lot about this sort of thing and the spiritual forces that energize many of the people out there. Well, now, Hillary was well aware of all of Bill's affairs. In fact, we're talking about dozens and dozens of women during their so-called, was it really an open marriage?
Well, it was certainly an open marriage as far as he was concerned. Whether she was indulging in the same kind of thing as he is still not exactly clear to some of us who've looked into it, because other than Vince Foster, it is very hard to pin down exactly what is the true nature of Hillary's sexuality.
But didn't she have many lesbian friends and people, lesbians working with her?
Well, very many, yes, and still does, for that matter. Has always been surrounded by many lesbian women.
And, of course, really a tragedy would be if Hillary were to become the next president of the United States, and yet, if you look at the polls, why, she's got a pretty good chance of getting there, and, you're certainly not winning any points with the next president. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Ed Klein. His book, The Truth About Hillary. If you have a question, why, the telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And did you really try to do an impartial analysis of her? In other words, did you try to show both sides?
Well, I certainly, when I set out to do the book, I did. But I soon learned that with Hillary, there really isn't another side. I know that sounds hard to believe, but I've written about many people in my life, and I've rarely found a character who I couldn't find something good to say about. And in Hillary's case, the only thing good I can say about her is that she has been brilliant in her manipulation of her Senate colleagues since she's been in the Senate for the last 4.5 years, and has established herself as a powerful figure in the Senate leadership. And she's done that perhaps more effectively than any senator since Lyndon Johnson.
It's almost as if there's an invisible force behind Hillary helping at every turn. Did you ever have that feeling?
I did. There are some people who think that she's actually being helped by the Republicans in order for them to see her as the next Democratic nominee, because if she did run as the Democratic nominee for president, the story goes, the Republicans would be able to energize their conservative base, raise huge amounts of money to defeat her, and would be able to win the election. I think that there's a lot of truth to all that, except I'm not as sure as the Republicans that she's going to be that easy to knock off.
Well, I think that it's sort of like running John Kerry, in my estimation. The Republicans couldn't have had a better candidate to run against George Bush. But let's get that, rather than get into partisan politics, one of the points you make out that when Hillary was pregnant, why, she told the press about a pregnancy there in Arkansas before she even told the president, and Bill Clinton learned his wife was president. What was it, reading the paper or listening to the television?
Well, actually, Bill Clinton was sitting in the the governor's office in Little Rock in 1979, in the early fall of 1979, and he opened the, there are two newspapers in those days, now they've combined into one. He opened the Democrat and he opened the Gazette, and there, lo and behold, were two stories, saying that Hillary Rodham had announced that she was pregnant.
But she hadn't told her husband.
And she hadn't told him about it. That's how he found out about it. And what's so amazing is this really tells us almost everything we need to know about the nature of that marriage, which was hardly what I call an intimate marriage in which the two parties shared their deepest feelings with each other.
Would you might even call it dysfunctional from a certain point of view?
We should.
In fact, as you point out in your book, why Hillary is was a mother, but she certainly was never maternal in any way, shape, or form.
That's correct.
All right, well, we've got Patrick calling from Pennsylvania. Hi, Patrick. How are you doing? I have a question for our guest.
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen.
Speak up a little louder, please.
Okay. I'm curious to know, is there any truth to the story that Hillary was named in a divorce suit in Washington?
Hillary was named in a divorce... Well, what are you speaking of?
Well, she was having an affair with a woman, and she was named in a divorce suit down in Washington, D.C.
All right. Did you ever heard that story?
I have not, but, you know, that doesn't mean it's not true. I just haven't heard the story.
Nor have I. So if you could have anything written on that, that you could verify it, we'd love to hear from you, Patrick.
Okay, fine.
Okay, thanks so much, and let's
go to
Carlos, who's calling from Carson City. Hi, Carlos. How are you doing?
Good evening, Dr. Stan and Mr. Klein. I got a couple of questions here for Mr. Klein. Mr. Klein, first of all, I've heard from a number of scholars, or I've read from a number of scholars, that Hillary is a relative of the Rothschilds, and Mr. Clinton is a relative of the Rockefellers. That's one of my questions.
All right, fine. Have you heard anything about that?
No, I can't say I've ever heard any of that.
I think we might, though, comment about the story of how she was able to play down this fact that she had actually gone up and hugged Arafat's wife, that's Arafat, the Palestinian leader, and it raised quite a ruckus when she went up on the stage and hugged Mrs. Arafat, and then all the Jews were mad at her. So how did she handle that?
Well, she discovered a long-lost step-great-grandfather who she claimed was half-Jewish. This is in an effort to pander to the Jewish vote in New York City. Of course, who knows if it was true or not.
And, Carlos, I've heard both of those stories. Go ahead.
I don't think the grandfather's name was Rothschild.
Yeah. I think, Carlos, there are a lot of stories out there, but you got to have the facts, and don't believe everything you hear, either on talk radio or certainly on the Internet. But anything else, Carlos?
Well, yes, definitely. My second theme here is that I'm fairly suspicious that the whole scenario built around the Monica Lewinsky affair with Mr. Clinton was a deceptive mechanism to deflect attention from what I think was something very crucial that was going on in the Clinton administration, which was the giveaway of technology to the Chinese.
All right. Well, certainly these things were going on together, but Carlos thinks that this may have been some sort of a deflection intentionally done. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. I think the president came so close to being impeached, and that it seems highly unlikely that he would have taken this kind of a risk to lose his job as president, to divert attention from this transfer of technology to the Chinese. Now, we do know that such transfers of technology were going on, and however, there were people at the time, mostly conservatives, I must say, who were pointing a finger at the administration and complaining about this transfer of technology, and were demanding that it be stopped because this technology was very vital to national security. So there were two separate stories, but I don't think they were connected.
Okay, thanks so much for calling, Carlos. And we have other callers, but right now we'll just go a little bit more of the details. Our guest this evening is Ed Klein. His book is The Truth About Hillary. And, you know, of course, Hillary certainly is getting everything in place. She's even raising money now, isn't she, for her presidential run? Or has she actually admitted that she is going to run?
No, she hasn't yet admitted that. In fact, she has her standard reply, which is, my only focus right now is on being reelected senator from New York State. But she's, of course, never denied that she would run for president, and it is clear to those of us who follow her closely that she has actually set up what I would call a below-the-radar kind of campaign organization in Washington. Keep in mind she's running for senator in New York State, but this operation is in Washington because it's a national operation, and she's assigned several of her top aides to this operation, which is clearly geared to getting her the nomination of her party in 2008 for the presidency.
You know, the thing that really amazes me is how, you know, whenever the media wants somebody to make a comment, they go to Hillary Clinton if they want a Democrat. They go to John McCain if they want a Republican. Now, there are 100 senators. There are a lot of senators we'll never see on television, but they will always go to Hillary. She's being pushed by some very powerful people, as is Senator McCain. Do you have this feeling at all that they're almost planned program to put these people forward as the real leaders of their parties?
I do indeed. In fact, as you know, my book, The Truth About Hillary, is not a flattering portrait of her, but it mildly. And as a result, the New York Times, which wants to see her run for president, has run 8 separate derogatory negative stories about my book in order to discredit me and to discourage people from reading it. They are coming to her defense by criticizing me and my book. So if the New York Times, which sets the agenda for so much of the liberal mainstream press, is doing that, you can be sure that there is a tremendous bias in favor of Hillary among the media.
And there certainly is. Well, let's go to Jeannie, who's calling from the Aptos area. Hi, Jeannie. Do you have a question for our guest?
Well, this book sounds very interesting.
It really is a fascinating book, Jeannie.
Has Ken written anything about Hillary's doings down in Central America?
No, they're talking about when she was working with that organization on El Salvador.
Well, that was one where she was chair of the New World Foundation and donated $6,000 to CEPUS, which is a communist front organization. And CEPUS actually bought anti-personnel bombs that look like toys for the children. And they, specifically the communists, targeted the children so they would be maimed, and so the parents would have to stay home and take care of the children and not fight the communists in the war in El Salvador.
All right. Well, let's get Mr. Klein's response to that. Right. Have you heard anything at all about her activities as far as Central America was concerned and her affiliation with the radical left-wing movement there?
I certainly have heard about it, and it doesn't surprise me. I mean, keep in mind that when Hillary was in Yale Law School, she interned for in California for two communist lawyers, a guy named Truhoff and his wife, Jessica Mistler, who were members of the American Communist Party and who were at that time supporting the violence-prone Black Panther Party here in the United States. Hillary learned an awful lot about politics from these two communists, and her behavior ever since has shown it.
All right, anything else, Jeannie?
Well, I want to mention that word is getting around Central America that Hillary is actually the godmother to one of the sons of Joaquin Villalobos. Now, this is a very important name in the war in El Salvador because he was the top communist commander that brought all the communist groups together to fight the people in El Salvador.
All right.
So she's very tightly aligned with the Marxist socialists down there.
Okay. Thank you so much, Jane. Right. Appreciate that. Okay, fine. Well, certainly nobody would ever accuse her of being a middle-of-the-roader, and yet, of course, when we read some of the things that in the media, they tell us that one time she was a Goldwater supporter. Is there any truth to that?
Well, her father was a definite conservative in the 1950s and early 60s, and Hillary inherited, so to speak, adopted her parents' politics, which was Goldwater Republicanism. And in high school, she was known as a Goldwater girl. However, while she was still in high school, she came under the influence of a youth group minister at her local Methodist church. This youth group minister, who was eventually fired by the church for his socialistic leanings, inculcated in Hillary a real sense of what I would call guilt over being a white middle class girl in the suburbs of Chicago while the minority people were in poverty in the ghettos of Chicago. In fact, he took her and other high school kids to Chicago to show them how these minority people lived and making them feel that they ought to do something about it, that it was their fault. And a lot of her socialistic leanings came from her influence from this youth group minister. And then these leanings were this, to change the metaphor, these seedlings of socialism were watered and blossomed when she went away to college, to Wellesley College, an all-girls school, where she enrolled in 1965 during the height of the anti-Vietnam War and counterculture revolution. And she, of course, became a student leader and in the forefront of this this revolution, and adopted, as I said before, many of the radical feminist and lesbian agenda of that time and that place.
Well, now, one of the things is that when John Kerry was running for the presidency, had he become the president, it would have meant that she probably couldn't have run in 2008, and that would have sort of ended her opportunity of getting the White House. And yet, supposedly, she was an ardent Kerry supporter. Was she really, or was she more or less simply going through the motions?
She was definitely just going through the motions. I mean, there was no question that her whole strategy was to see Kerry defeated, so that she would have a clear shot at 2008. And she did this in many different ways, largely by not really going all out and raising money for him, but also by claiming to campaign for him when in fact she was campaigning for congressional and Senate nominees, candidates, not Kerry. And she often did it in states where Kerry had absolutely no chance of winning. And so her appearances in those states would not be of any value to him.
All right. So poor old John Kerry came very, very close to winning the presidency of the United States. And Hillary, I remember so well during the campaign. And I think Ed is entirely right. She went through the motions of being a loyal Democrat of supporting him. But, of course, the last thing she wanted was John Kerry to win the presidency in 2004 and, of course, prevent her from running in 2008. So she is unscrupulous. She'll certainly utilize anyone and destroy anyone who gets in her way. We're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program. And the book, of course, is The Truth About Hillary. It's available. It's available at all bookstores, isn't it, Ed?
Oh, absolutely. You can get it in all the bookstores. You can get it online, of course, at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. At a great discount.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. You were going to say you get the book at a great discount whereabouts?
Well, at Walmart and Costco and Sam's Clubs, all the large discount chain stores.
Right, and it's well worthwhile reading. It's really written in a sort of a book that draws you into it. And, of course, Mr. Klein's been writing for a long, long time, having been a foreign editor for Newsweek magazine. Although I find it difficult to find a former editor there, a foreign editor at Newsweek, being a Bush supporter. But I guess we all change during the course of our lives and how we look at the world.
That's certainly true.
Okay. Well, we've got about 2 minutes for you to wrap up your thoughts this evening before we let you go. So what message would you like to leave with our listeners this evening?
Well, the thing that I remember most from my own book is the scene in which shortly after he returned in 1993 from Russia, Richard Nixon received a phone call from Bill Clinton. He, Nixon, had never been allowed to come back to the White House as an official guest by previous presidents. But this Democratic president asked him to come and brief him on Russia. So Nixon shows up at the White House, and he's escorted into the upstairs to the family quarters. And there, lo and behold, are not only the president, but the First Lady, and Chelsea. The first thing the First Lady says to him is, "Mr. Nixon, we are adopting a lot of your policies for health care in my health care proposal, and it's a shame that yours never went through." And Nixon later said he thought to himself what it might have gone through if she hadn't been part of the effort to impeach me. Hillary was on that impeachment inquiry. Then they sit down and they talk about Russia. And Nixon notices that when Hillary tries to move near her daughter Chelsea, Chelsea moves away as though she's not eager to be close to her mother. And she moves toward her father, and that she's much closer to Bill Clinton than she is to Chelsea, than she is to Hillary. At the end of this meeting, after listening to Clinton talk and listening to Hillary talk, Nixon leaves and tells his aide, who he's traveling with that day, that Bill Clinton is a smart guy, he's got good intelligence, but that he's not experienced in foreign affairs, and he expects the rest of the world to go along with him on his policies by just asking them and sort of pleading with
them. Hold that thought there. Well, Ed is telling us, finishing up the program, telling us about Richard Nixon's impression in 1993, Richard Nixon's return from a trip to Russia. He's invited to the White House by Bill Clinton to praise him of what Nixon had found in Russia. After they leave the meeting, Nixon tells his aide, would you like to repeat that before we let you go?
Yes, and it'll only take a second. He tells his aide, the trouble with Clinton is that he's kind of soft. But Hillary, on the other hand, says Nixon, she inspires deer. And I think that's something that we all should remember, that Hillary inspires fear, and there's a good reason that she does, because she has no business being in the Oval Office of the White House.
Amen to that. Well, Ed Klein, it's the third interview we've had with you. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll look forward to your next book.
Dr. Stan, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your having me on so many times. You're wonderful, and I very much deeply appreciate it.
Bye-bye, and God bless. Bye-bye. All right, well, that was Ed Klein, his book, The Truth About Hillary, and we do hope that that some of you will be interested in getting the book. Well, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and if any of you are interested in helping us, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to helping us as we do everything we possibly can to reach out across America on a regular basis to try to educate people about what's really going on in the world. And so we would certainly encourage you in every possible way to go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And there you can listen to our programs on the Internet. Or you can listen to our programs actually either directly or indirectly 5 hours a day. That's 5 hours a day on the Internet somewhere in America. You can get our shortwave programs. And the message we're trying to get out, we are involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. When you get into the background of what's going on in the White House, there are dark occult forces there, and that's why I brought up the story of Hillary Clinton. That's why wanting to actually conjure up the spirit, bring in Jean Houston to conjure up the spirit of Eleanor Roosevelt. And this is the sort of thing that really does go on. There are these people who have a different agenda, who have a different worldview. And many of these people are deeply involved in the occult, both in the Republican and the Democrat Party. Remember that Nancy Reagan was involved with astrology, and there are many people who believe that Ronald Reagan was too. We have a book called The Dove Connection that goes into that aspect, but it goes against everything that the average individual believes, because Ronald Reagan said everything that I believe. He was against big government, but he increased the size of government more than any other president up to that time. He was against deficit spending, but he gave us the biggest deficits of all time. He certainly was very much against the communists, but he ended up embracing Gorbachev. Sometimes there's very little relationship between reality and perception, so you must understand that many times our views are created, our minds are molded, our tastes are formed, our ideas are suggested largely by men we have never heard of. Those are the words of Edward Bernays. They were written 76 years ago, but they're as true today as they were then. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Again, our website is www.radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. So we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And, of course, we're going to be back for the same hour, with the second hour of the program here, but to those of you who are having to leave us, why, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. And we ask you, invite your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Andrew Skousen of World Affairs Brief, and we're going to be talking about current events and the important issues that affect all of us every day right here in America. So without further ado, Andrew, thank you so very much for being with us. Wait a minute, I guess we're getting Andrew on the line now. Hopefully Andrew will be with us in just a moment. But Andrew is Joel Skousen's son, and of course Joel has been one of our featured guests here for many years. He writes the World Affairs Brief, but he's doing some traveling at the present time, so we take turns having Andrew and Derek on our program to keep us abreast of the material that you'll find at www.worldaffairsbrief.com. And I try to go there every morning. Once in a while I don't, but ordinarily I go there every day to find out what the major news stories are. And it means that I don't have to spend hours surfing the net and going to WorldNet Daily and newswithviews.com. And Paul Craig Roberts and the Rents, they go through all these and they pull down what they think are the important issues. And usually if something important happened that the media is not covering, and you must understand that most of the important issues, most of the important stories are not going to get into the media. You're going to get a lot of confusing and contradictory stories through the major media. They're going to be overloaded with information intentionally so that you cannot see what's going on. The World Affairs Brief crystallizes fairly well what's going on. It gives you the articles out of Asia Times and out of India Times and out of BBC and Reuters, and you get an overview of what's going on in the world. You're getting the information that the people who control the American media do not want you to get. And without further ado, Andrew Skousen, how are you this evening?
Just fine, Dr. Stan. Thank you for having me on the air.
Okay, fine. Well, what are the issues we're going to be talking about this evening?
Well, I'd like to address a little bit about the recent passage of CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and talk about how it doesn't address free trade. Maybe we could talk about some of the effects that it has about natural supplements, and maybe tap into a little bit of your knowledge base on that. And then I'd like to move over to the Middle East and talk about some of the recent developments there. And if we have time, I'd like to talk about some very interesting developments with the London bombings and some interesting eyewitness accounts of that.
All right, fine. Well, if you start right out there, let's talk about CAFTA. I think it's fascinating. You know, if somebody were to give one of the congressmen or senators money for a vote, that would be illegal and they would go to jail. But Dennis Hassert went to a congressman from, I think it was North or South Carolina. They needed his vote because, after all, if they could change his vote, they could win by two votes. And they promised to give him whatever he wanted. He said he wanted special protection for the textiles in his state. That's fine. We'll give you whatever you ask. We just want your vote. Now, that is illegal. I mean, he is supposed to represent his people in his district, not the powers from above. But when the Speaker of the House comes to you and offers and tells you you are going to vote his way and he'll give you what you want, why are you giving up your vote? Representing your people in exchange for a benefit, and that benefit, of course, is going to benefit him getting reelected. This isn't representative of his people. This is simply control from the top down. We've lost representative government, ladies and gentlemen. We're rapidly moving towards an authoritarian society. Right here in what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave. And CAFTA is simply one more nail in the coffin of America's sovereignty. Well, Andrew, why don't you pick up the story?
Well, I appreciate that introduction into CAFTA. I think it is actually a very valid point to the overall story of how CAFTA passed. Because if you look at what happened with the vote, it becomes very obvious that this was a bill that the established powers on Capitol Hill really wanted it passed.
And the people didn't want it passed, but that didn't matter what the people wanted.
That's right. And a very interesting article occurred in Democracy Now, which says, I think it's worth quoting, it says, in a midnight vote, Congress narrowly approved the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. The final vote was 217-215 in favor of CAFTA. But last night's vote came with a major twist. When official voting had ended at 11:17 p.m., as the 15-minute voting period had expired, legislators had actually voted to defeat CAFTA by a vote of 180-175. Notice that's a good deal number of votes less than the final vote count, 217-215. So the quote continues, Republican leaders took the unusual move of holding the vote open for another 47 minutes, furiously rounding up holdouts in their own party until they had secured just enough to ensure approval. Now, it stood at 180-175, so during this 47 minutes, they woke up how many other people who were trying to avoid this vote and getting them to vote to bring the tally up another 27 votes in favor. While that was occurring, a lot of other people were obviously being woken up to come and vote against it. And that came out to be a whole 30 that came out of the woodwork to vote against it. So it was obvious that as soon as it came out in favor of CAFTA, that they quickly shut it back down. And, to open up the vote for just 47 minutes exactly is very strange. So this was an obvious way to get this bill passed.
Well, there's no question about that, Andrew, but I think the people have to understand that we no longer have representative government. There's an elite
right.
that runs this country, and they believe in globalism, the destruction of America's national sovereignty, the destruction of our jobs, the transfer of our industries, the impoverishment of our people, and we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and we're just talking about the shenanigans, the power structure, the arm twisting, the bribery, frank bribery of the various congressmen to get them to vote, to change their vote, because the powers that be, the elite who run America, were intent upon getting this through. Why? Because they do not believe in America. Their loyalty is the internationalist dream, the New World Order, the New World Religion. So pick up the story there, Andrew.
Thank you for that. And it's exactly true what you say. Many people wonder, though, well, how is it that something like CAFTA, which is labeled as free trade for the Americas, can actually encourage these things that we're warning people about? And I think to be able to answer that, we have to examine a little bit more about what CAFTA involves. The proponents of CAFTA say that, well, it's going to establish free trade, take down embargoes and impediments to trade between some of the Central American nations, specifically six small Central American nations, to encourage trade back and forth between our boundaries. Now, from a libertarian point of view, this is actually a good policy, free trade, to encourage unimpeded transfer of goods across the border without tariffs that create a sort of unjust measurement across the board of tariffs is a good policy in our opinion, but CAFTA itself is not about free trade, and this was made particularly evident when, while they were trying to round up votes during this legislative session, they were only able to round up votes from several of the congressmen by promising them to regulate and add restrictions to the CAFTA Pact, to add restrictions on the transfer of sugar, textiles, and other products that several of these voters were worried about.
Because if you really wanted free trade, you would just have a one-page statement, we want free trade. This is
exactly.
Over 1,000 pages. Has nothing to do with free trade. It has to do with controlled trade. The South Carolina or congressman who switched his vote did it on the promise that they'd get protection for the textile industry. Now, you know, that doesn't sound like free trade. That sounds like bribery to me.
That's right. And the hidden inside of those 1,000 pages of the CAFTA agreement is quite a lot of legal structure that encourages or that ties the legal structure of how American restrictions on certain products specifically is enforced. Basically, it gives the power to a supranational organization, in this case, under the CAFTA agreement, more power would be given to the World Trade Organization, the WTO, to create a body that would have powers to enforce certain items of consumer goods that are the kinds of goods that are transferred between these two countries. So basically, it creates a framework to allow a governing body outside of the United States to govern what goes on inside of our borders. And probably the best example of this is this part about the Codex Alimentarius.
All right. Of course, for our listeners out there, this is where they're going to be able to regulate the amount of vitamins and minerals and capsules, and then they're going to be able to say which ones are good for you and which ones are not, and they can even outlaw them if they want to. But it gives them, supranational organization, the ability to regulate what goes on within the borders of the United States. Totally unconstitutional, but it is really the transfer of the sovereignty of this country to international agencies, and that's what this is really all about, an international bureaucracy that will determine your future and may very well be able to deprive you of things that are beneficial and necessary for your health. But you must understand there really are evil and wicked people out there who would deprive you of the ability to have the things that you need to maintain your health, because after all, many people within the bureaucracy honestly believe there are too many people in the world, and we'd be better off to eliminate half, two-thirds, three-quarters, nine-tenths of the world's population. Could they possibly do something like that? We'll pick up the story there, Andrew.
Okay. Well, the Codex Alimentarius was originally a European idea, part of the European Union Agreement, and when it was first introduced, it was considered far too draconian of a measure about restricting the amount of natural remedies and resources that common people have to vitamins and minerals and natural remedies without a doctor's prescription. And this is, as one person said, under the European Directive on Dietary Supplements, which became law in August, it severely restricts the types and quantities of supplements that may be legally sold. Most forms of vitamin C and E, for example, are not available or are available only in extremely small doses. And if current plans proceed on course, American consumers as well are in for the same kind of shock. What they're talking about is an article in or a portion of the CAFTA agreement. Now, to clarify, CAFTA does not mandate this codex, this enforcement of rules and restrictions on the amount of natural remedies and vitamins that we can buy off the shelf for our own goods. But it requires, the CAFTA does, requires of all the member states that they form a sanitary and phytosanitary committee for the purpose of ensuring ongoing harmonization under the terms of this agreement in the World Trade Organization. Now, the consulting issues that they're talking about involved in this harmonization include a specific reference to the Codex Alimentarius. And since we have passed this CAFTA now, CAFTA is going to create this SPS board, this Sanitary and Phytosanitary Board, which under CAFTA is meant to put in place something very similar to Codex, according to its language. Now, if the powers that are in this organization try to restrict natural vitamins and things here in the United States, which they could under CAFTA, but which we don't think that they will right off the bat, because this is a very touchy subject with a lot of Americans, and there would be a huge backlash.
Okay, but everything they do it just a little at a time, very slowly and patiently. I mean, they've been at this for several hundred years. Just a little here, a little there, a little freedom here, a little change there, a little expansion of federal police power, and then massive expansion of federal police power, and then monitoring of individuals and putting up the video cameras and requiring a national ID card in the name of course, a driver's license. And then, of course, we find that now under Echelon, they can tap our emails and our faxes and listen to our telephone calls. But, of course, it's all done in the name of national security, and it happens so slowly and subtly, and it doesn't seem to affect us. So we're really not concerned until one day we awaken, and freedom as we know it is simply a remembrance of things past.
That's right. It's the boil the frog slowly scenario, exactly. We would jump free of the boiling water if it was turned up to the temperature that they have the power to turn it up to right now. But obviously, they're going to be learn to be smarter than that. I think that there's a couple of comments about this issue by a Congressman Ron Paul, who, for many people who don't know him, he is a congressman who was originally a medical doctor. He's from Texas, and I think that some of his comments told before Congress are very applicable. I'll quote from a few of the things they said. He says, like WTO, the World Trade Organization, CAFTA increases the possibility that Codex regulations will be imposed on the American public. Section 6 of CAFTA discusses Codex as a regulatory standard for nations that join the agreement. If CAFTA has nothing to do with dietary supplements, as CAFTA supporters claim, why in the world does it specifically mention Codex, he says.
And of course, the thing is that they lie. They over and over again will say, well, this would never happen, and then it happens, and they say, oh, well, we didn't know that.
Right. How could we have foreseen that?
How could we have foretold that? They know, and ladies and gentlemen, I hate to tell you, but politicians lie.
Precisely. Whew. That's a pretty tough pill to swallow there, Dr. Stan. I absolutely agree with you.
Okay, fine. So I share your concern about Codex and about, and I think it'll be very slowly. I think it'll happen so slowly that people really won't understand what's happening. But little by little, gradually, like a thief at night, why, of course, working a little here and a little there, until eventually all of our freedom will be centralized in Washington, D.C. And, of course, freedom as we know it will exist no more. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief. And if you don't go there every morning and get your information, well, you must be getting it from the controlled media. And remember, there are five mega corporations that dominate the media. They're Disney, they're Bertelsmann, there's Viacom, there's Fox, and there's Time Warner. And they determine what most people read and hear and believe in. All right, Andrew, pick up the story from there.
All right, well, I'd like to mention a slightly different force of pro-CAFTA support that happened during the process of this. And it came from some of the major pharmaceutical industries. Now, many people may wonder why it is that the pharmaceutical industries would be encouraging something like the Central American Free Trade Agreement. And part of the purpose of it was that they wanted to protect their own interests, as I think most people realize there are a great deal of cheap medical or medicines and drugs that can be had south of the border and from other southern or South American countries. And obviously the big pharmaceutical industries were keen on not opening up the free trade so that they could keep more of a control and let's call it what it is, a monopoly on the pharmaceutical industry here in the United States. So these major pharmaceutical companies spent billions of dollars trying to get Washington to regulate dietary supplements. This is, I think, one of the major reasons that the drug companies were in favor of CAFTA is because they have been unable to encourage legislation restricting the free flow of dietary supplements through just off the shelf, being able to buy it off the shelf right from the store that consumers have the freedom to do now. And in 1994, there was a law passed called the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, and the major pharmaceutical companies and the medical establishment dislike strongly this act because it allows consumers a good deal of freedom to buy the supplements that they want. Americans, of course, like this freedom, especially the baby boomer generation, which is becoming more and more health conscious as they get older and older, and this information is more and more widespread. So the drug companies support CAFTA because they see international trade agreements as being a way to do an end run around American law and restrict supplements through international regulation, which is exactly the kind of force that CAFTA is putting us under. Now, the major name brand pharmaceutical companies have inserted language into this document, which specifically covers the Dominican Republic as well as the other nations of Central America, to prevent all of the cheaper generic drug manufacturers from selling their products, including some of the life-preserving antiretroviral treatments for AIDS victims. All of this is reported by Ron Paul, as I mentioned earlier. So these two major reasons the pharmaceutical companies have been encouraging the passing of CAFTA, and I think it was one of the major reasons why it did pass, was because of the strong lobbying that these big pharmaceutical agencies had behind them. Obviously, they have a great deal of cash with all of the drugs that they sell in the American market, and it's creating a difficult atmosphere.
Hold that off right there, please.
All right,
fine. This is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Andrew Skousen, and he's just saying that the pharmaceutical industry certainly wants to be able to control us. If they want to force us to buy certainly the vitamins through them, and of course to have such small amounts, we're going to have to buy an awful lot of them. They really want, of course, to put us into a situation where we cannot buy our drugs in other countries. Pick up the story there, please.
Okay, well, I was talking about CAFTA, and we've discussed it, I think, at length about how this agreement that passed recently in Congress was not an agreement about free trade. We talked about the various clauses that actually prohibited free trade of the major substances that could have been imported.
Okay, well, let's get on then to the next subject that we're going to talk about.
Okay, go ahead. Well, moving on to world politics, I think.
Do you want to talk about what's going on as far as the London bombing is concerned? I'd be fascinated by that.
Okay, let's do.
Okay, go ahead.
Absolutely. There were some very interesting recent developments in the London bombing cases, specifically about how the evidence has been hidden from us about what has been actually revealed in the past couple of weeks about this. And to get an idea about how much information should actually be available on these bombings, it's interesting to look at the amount of video cameras and all of the videotape that should be available on these subjects. I think it's a good idea to tell our listeners about the full extent of the video monitoring service that London has in place. London is possibly has the most widespread camera system of all of the major countries. It has multiple cameras on every transportation bus, in every transportation terminal, in every corner of the underground terminals and inside of the buses. So there should have been, according to most analysis, of these four Muslim-looking people who traveled some 45 minutes to the major hub where they split up, and then there should have been at least another 35 minutes approximately for each of these people before the bombs were actually released, of footage and camera recording of these people. And yet none of this exists except for the few pictures of the four people that is mentioned and not shown of them splitting up at the major destination where they all split up.
And what you're basically saying is then that we're not seeing all of the film footage that they obviously have.
That's right, exactly.
Okay, now why wouldn't they want to make that available? That doesn't quite make sense. You would think that they want to show that how effective their video cameras were in surveillance. So why are they concealing some of this? As they have, for instance, after the bombing in Oklahoma City, so much of the video footage just disappeared. So what are you suggesting?
I'm trying to suggest that it's following the same scenario that we've seen in just about every major terrorist occurrence that has happened, in the 9/11 terrorist attacks. There have been all kinds of video camera confiscations that had pictures of the planes and the vehicles that were used to attack the building. Footage often was hidden and not released to the public. We still don't have, for instance, the voice recordings of the pilots together with the people in the towers.
And so we know
that obviously would have happened.
And we know that those recordings immediately after the attack, why all of the air traffic controllers were interviewed, and so they would have a permanent record that very day, and all that record was destroyed. And we do note that the video cameras that were fixed on the Pentagon that day of the attack, all of that footage has disappeared. So the question is, if there's nothing to conceal, why are they concealing it? And of course, then we go to London and the London bombing. You're suggesting there's a lot of footage that should be available and isn't. And the question is, what's really going on? We're going to be back here in just a moment with Andrew Skousen asking some serious questions, which everybody should be asking about what's going on today. Bale, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Andrew Skousen. Andrew, pick up the story from there.
Okay. Well, I'd like to quote from an eyewitness who has been published recently about his testimony. This was an eyewitness on one of the trains that had occurred during the bombing, and he has some very interesting information about what happened. This was reported by Mark Falk on his website, falkingtruth.com. And he says, the eyewitness that he's quoting says, in the Cambridge Evening News, 32-year-old dance instructor Bruce Lay, in an interview from his hospital bed, said, the policeman said, mind that hole, that's where the bomb was. This is the eyewitness describing what happened after the explosion. He was on board the train, and after the explosion occurred, the policemen were telling him to watch out as he exited the train because of the big blast hole that had occurred inside the train, very close to where he and his dance partner were. He said that the metal was pushed upwards out of the bottom of the train as if the bomb was underneath the train. He says, they seem to think that the bomb was left in a bag, but I don't remember anybody being where the bomb was or any bag. While describing the scene, Lay said that he and his dance partner, Crystal Main, said that out of that whole carriage, I think Crystal and I were the only ones who were not seriously injured, and I think we were nearest the supposed location of the bomb. He went on to describe those sitting closest to him and Main when the bomb went off. He said, I remember an Asian guy, there was a white guy with a tracksuit, trousers, and a baseball cap, and there were two old ladies sitting opposite me. Lay didn't remember seeing anyone or a bag that could be holding a bomb near the point of detonation because there was no bomber sitting there, and there was no bag.
And, of course, what you're saying is that it looked like the metal was lifted up out of the floor of the cars, if the bomb was underneath the cars, what you're suggesting.
Right, and so if this eyewitness's testimony can be trusted, and it lends evidence to the fact that the bomb was somehow installed on the train in a way that a normal passenger could not have installed it.
Now, there's somebody that had to be underneath the train putting it there, and of course then it was time to go off at a specific time.
Right, which could not have happened unless they had access to the to the location of the trains beforehand.
Hold that thought right there.
Yeah.
Well, this is Dr. Scan, and our guest is Andrew Skousen, and he's certainly been telling that there is one report up on the Internet that somebody who was on one of the London trains in the subway said that when they were in the car that where the explosion took place, that most of the people were injured, but there was nobody sitting in the area where the bomb went off. And as they were getting out of the train, they noticed that the metal on the floor was pushed upward as if the explosion had come from below. If the explosion had taken place in the train, it would have come from the metal would have been pushed down. But here the metal was pushed up, suggesting that the bomb was installed underneath the train and went off and then injured the people in the car. Now, is this true? Well, we're just going to have to wait and see. But as time goes by, more and more stories are going to come out that may challenge what we've been told. Now, before we go on, Andrew, I do want you to tell our listeners how they can get your material from World Affairs Brief.
Certainly. I think that one of the best ways for people to gain access to the material is by logging on to our website, which is www.worldaffairsbrief.com. There they can access some of the same resources that we use to write the World Affairs Brief. We're constantly scanning the news, and we provide links to all of the stories that we think are important, many of which we reference inside of the World Affairs Brief. That website is found at www.worldaffairsbrief.com. That's www.worldaffairsbrief.com. Now, if there is anyone who would like to to order the World Affairs Brief, they can find links to that on that same website, or they can call toll-free 1-877-518-5888, and they can either order the World Affairs Brief through that number, or they can get a complimentary printed brief of or a sample brief sent to them by mail.
All right, fine. Again, that telephone number is what?
Is 1-877-518-5888, and that's toll-free.
Okay, fine. That's 5. Is that 5888?
That's correct.
All right,
area
fine.
Area code 877-518-5888.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, that's an excellent summary and excellent analysis of what's going on. I read it every week when it comes in. Now, let's get back to the London bombing. Were there any other eyewitness accounts that we have not heard of here in the United States?
Well, although we haven't uncovered very many eyewitness accounts, obviously this information is still filtering through. I think it's important to note that we don't have certain information which would be critical to determine whether or not this eyewitness case was true or not. Specifically, the camera recorded images that should be available from all of these forms of transportation that were taken that probably would have filmed the same areas where the explosions had taken place.
And I think that people have to understand, in London they have the George Orwell Society. They have the video cameras everywhere. Everybody's being watched. And they would have had videos in that car. They would have known what had happened. And those video footage apparently is just, well, it just mysteriously disappeared. Or if it hasn't disappeared, we're certainly not being allowed to see it. Would that be a fair statement?
It's true. Now, I think one other item that is, or one other related issue to this that has come up recently is the case of the innocent Brazilian that was shot recently by London police. And some of the information that isn't told about that story in the common press, I think, is worth noting. Now, according to the official story, this was an innocent Brazilian who was surveyed and tracked to the London subway. The police told the press that this man lived at a flat that they were staking out, and that he was shot that day because he failed to halt when undercover police officers called for him to halt. He, quote, jumped a turnstile, and he was wearing a, quote, thick padded jacket that could possibly have contained explosives. I think we've all heard this story, and we all understood why the police had to take that action. But on closer examination, some of this evidence was not true.
Didn't they actually have some pictures of this fellow and that running? Was that picture of him that we saw running?
I'm not sure exactly of the video you're...
Okay, you go right ahead.
Yeah, but according to the UK Herald, a relative, Vivian Figueredo, whose age is 22, said she had asked to be shown the closed-circuit television footage from the station, but had not yet been allowed to view it. However, she said she was told by police officers that her cousin had been wearing a denim jacket and had used his travel card to get through the station barrier. She said, quote, I spoke to police on that day, and the police told me that he had used a travel card.
So that's a lot different than vaulting the turnstile. Would it be possible that they are lying to cover up the fact that they murdered an innocent man?
Very possibly. Now, I still think that it was a case of the police just being a little bit jumpy about this case and fabricating this evidence. But
you could understand
the television should describe that.
Right. You could understand why they would be. I mean, they might think that if he really were wearing a coat, that he might have a bomb underneath it. If they let him move, he might detonate the bomb and kill them. But, you know, the question is, you know, are we really being told the truth? When you have police officers who are frightened to death for their own safety, many times they'll act irresponsibly. Are we really being told the truth, or did, as we know that sometimes police officers here, after they've shot somebody, will plant a gun in his hand? Did they alter the story about his vaulting the turnstile and racing and being told to stop? You would think that anybody in their right mind, if they were told to stop, with the tensions running as high as they were in London at that time, would simply stop. Or was this simply used as an excuse to justify an execution?
That's right, and the cameras don't lie, and we should be able to tell based on the information from the cameras what the true story was about this case.
But we're not going to see the cameras, right?
And this is one of the problems with letting government have control of all of the surveillance equipment, is that it can pick and choose which sources of this no lie evidence that is available that they want to show to the rest of the public. And so it becomes basically that we have to rely on the government for our sources of information, sometimes about what the government has done. And it's a very upside down way of gaining evidence about these kinds of situations.
Well, I think the difficulty is that most people have an inherent trust of government, whereas our founding fathers had no trust of government at all. In fact, they feared government, and they feared government power, which is why they did not want a federal police force or a federal Bureau of Investigation or a central intelligence agency or an all-powerful government in Washington, D.C., because they knew that once all power was centralized in Washington, D.C., then freedom as we know it would soon be gone. Well, let's go to Jim, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Jim, did you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, yes, I did. Very interesting discussion, you guys. My timing's a little off, so this is concerning a subject you were discussing earlier. This is just an elementary question about the World Trade Organization. And my question is, you know, isn't that really part of the overall United Nations structure?
All right. Would you like to answer that, Andrew? Is the World Trade Organization part of the United Nations?
From what I understand, it is. It is the trade organization branch, or the branch of the United Nations that is in charge of governing international trade. Can they clarify any more than that, Dr. Stan?
Well, Jim, we have actually an advertisement that appeared in the New York Times, as I remember, and it was put in by the government of Morocco, and this was when the World Trade Organization was coming in, and it said the three pillars of world government, the United Nations, Bretton Woods, and the World Trade Organization. So these are the three pillars of this move towards the world fascist society. All the leaders of the world know about this. There is a plan, and it involves the leaders of the world. And if you want to know who they are and when they get together for their meetings, we'll be glad to send you the membership list of one of the recent meetings of the State of the World Forum, headed by that great American patriot, Mikhail Gorbachev. And these people are planning this whole thing. And, of course, it has to do with finances. It has to do with government. It has to do with the World Trade Organization. It also has to do with religion, because they want a world government. They want a world religion, and they want to destroy society as we know it. And along with that, a large part of the world's population.
All right. Well, you know, I'm just concerned that maybe, you know, President Bush is trying to bring us into the United Nations through the back door, perhaps through the World Trade Organization, and I'm concerned about that.
You ought to be.
I know that the World Trade Organization is going to and these treaties are going to marry us to Red China, which is the biggest purveyor of abortion in the world, basically.
Well, I think if there's an article that appears in the April 1974 issue of Foreign Affairs magazine. It's written by Richard Gardner, who's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a Rhodes Scholar, and he talks about how there's all this opposition to world government. And so we're going to have to do an end run around the Constitution, and we're going to have to use things like GATT, that's the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, the Law of the Sea Treaty, the World Trade Organization, and similar entities and these treaties to bring us into world government. You're absolutely right, Jim. Hey, thanks so much for calling.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, go ahead, Andrew.
All right, well, to sort of wrap up this story about the London trade bombings. I'm sorry, about the London bombings, is the major points of concern that I think occur right now. First of all, we don't have all of the information that the government and the police obviously have, which are in the case with all of the missing camera footage that we don't have access to. But also there's this source of too much evidence that has occurred. I think this is something that we've seen at the World Trade Center collapses. We've seen it at the Spain bombings when they found cars that were of very incriminating evidence, recordings of the Quran readings, etc., which were a little too good to be true, in my opinion. According to the police, there were personal documents, driver's licenses, credit cards, paper receipts, etc., etc., that were conveniently found near every single one of these bomb blasts, or most of the bomb blasts.
Wasn't that nice of the terrorists to leave them there so we could find them so we'd know who they were?
Exactly. And in the backpack that didn't explode, there was even more evidence that was found leading to other Confederates. Now, in my opinion, I don't think that terrorists that are smart enough to pull off this kind of combined attack within minutes of each other are so careless as to leave this kind of evidence about who they are specifically. I mean, if it was evidence about who their organization was, that might be one thing, but who they are specifically is a little too careless to actually believe. But if we take a different point of view, possibly that these were agent provocateurs who intended to plant evidence that would encourage the further arrests of a certain group of people and encourage a certain reaction from the public, this seems to fit that scenario a little bit better. Both the fact that we're missing the cameras that would have told the true story, so we have nothing but to believe speculation.
Well, we really don't know, and the thing is that whether the story we're getting is true or whether it's all contrived, we don't know, and they are concealing the evidence.
Right, exactly. But for now, the evidence that has been presented sounds fishy.
Well, I think we can notice the timing. The timing of the bombing was when certainly the popularity of Tony Blair had fallen. The attack was at first timed to coincide with a meeting of the G8 in Scotland. The timing of this whole thing really helped the Bush administration, because there's much unrest here in this country about the war in Iraq. But this only tends
to have passed the U.S. Patriot Act. Right. Division that were about to sunset.
You're absolutely right. And the perfect timing on the part of those wicked terrorists to help our government pass the Terrorist Act sure was very, very clever of them, wasn't it?
Yeah, they allowed the government to have more power to fight against the organization that they were supposedly part of.
Right. Okay, go ahead, Andrew.
All right. So let's see. About how much time do we have left?
Well, we've got about five more minutes.
About five more minutes. All right, shall we try to tack another story, possibly a slightly smaller one?
All right, go ahead.
I think most of our listeners will remember not too long ago when North Korea announced that it was going to go ahead and use the nuclear power plants that the United States was building at U.S. taxpayer expense for North Korea to actually use the plutonium, the depleted plutonium, to develop it into weapons-grade material. Now, this was specifically an item that they were not supposed to do. This was part of the agreement that the U.S. in a very foolhardy fashion, I believe, agreed to build these reactors on a pie-crust promise of North Korea that, no, it's okay, build these for us, but we won't use this weapons-grade plutonium that's left over to develop nuclear weapons.
Or did you ever stop to think that maybe we did that intentionally so they would be able to get the weapons-grade plutonium? Our leaders are not stupid. They certainly know that nothing the North Koreans said is true. They've starved to death millions of their own people. And when we built those plants, Why would we build those nuclear plants for them? Why would we be giving massive amounts of food aid and massive amounts of oil to this, keep this ruthless, tyrannical government in power? Is this another example of creating the best enemy money could buy? But we have to tell the American people, we're only doing this because, of course, we've got to have stability in North Korea. My goodness, the thing would fall apart if we didn't keep giving the money. And we've got to build those nuclear power plants so they won't build nuclear bombs. And now, shucks, they're gonna violate their promise. Who would ever have thought they'd do that? Well, I think anybody with half an ounce of intelligence would, and I think that we have some of the smartest people in the world in key positions in the government, and I think that time and time and time again, they're able to convince the American people that the truth is falsehood and falsehood is truth. It's like that statement, whoever would have thought that they'd take airplanes and fly them into American buildings. That's what Condi Rice said on the morning of the attack. Yet that very morning, our government was actually having an exercise simulating a plane flying into a government building. Isn't that a coincidence? And Condi didn't even know about that. All right, our guest is Andrew Skousen. Andrew, pick up the story there.
Well, at the major news breaking that North Korea was violating its agreement and openly thumbing its nose at the promises that it had made to the United States, of course, there was a great deal of hubbub and furor about, okay, well, we won't talk with Pyongyang anymore one-on-one. We're going to pull away all help and aid and trade, and all of these things were pulled away. Well, recently, President Bush has announced so-called bilateral talks. By definition, bilateral means one-on-one. And they have agreed to, or there has been promised massive food aid again. Historically, like you mentioned, Dr. Stan, this food aid, about 90% of it has gone to the vast armies that North Korea keeps on hand, and very, very little of it has gone to the general population, which has always been the excuse for giving out the massive food aid.
And of course, that army is used to keep that public enslaved. In other words, we feed the army that keeps the people enslaved there. What's wrong with this picture?
Right. So the amount of pandering to North Korea that has recently gone on, I think deserves comment. Some of the comments that they have said is that, quote, the United States said it recognized North Korea as a sovereign nation, was ready to address their security concerns, called for a full and verifiable dismantling of the North's nuclear weapons. We remain prepared to speak with the DPRK bilaterally in the context of these talks, repeated that the United States has no intention of attacking North Korea and called for it to dismantle its nuclear weapons fully and verifiably.
Now, how long have we been calling for them to do that? About 10 years now?
Exactly. And what does full and verifiable dismantling of weapons mean? Well, I think we've seen that before. Real verification never takes place of any secret underground facilities. Back in the day when the same topic of discussion was going on with Russia, Russia was given a free ride on verification as well. And I think North Korea is trying to get on that same boat.
And of course, we've created the best enemies money could buy in Russia and in communist China in preparation, in my estimation, for the coming world war. Andrew Skousen, thank you so very much for being with us. We're out of time. We could go on for another hour, but time is up. Good night. God bless.
Great. Good night, Dr. Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Now, to understand what's really going on in the world, let me suggest my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. It will help you to understand the dark spiritual forces that work behind the scenes. And there really are organizations where the leaders of the world get together. and plan our future. And if you have a question about that, we have the membership meetings from the recent State of the World Forum meetings headed by Mikhail Gorbachev. Who is Mikhail Gorbachev? Well, you need to get our latest newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy Part 2, which, of course, quotes from a book written by Wayne Peterson, who is part and parcel of this whole world occult movement. His book, Extraordinary Times, Extraordinary Beings. Not people, but extraordinary beings. And he tells about Gorbachev and his experiences in the occult and his wife's visit to Sai Baba, the satanic spiritual leader over in India, not once but on several occasions. And it's a fascinating book, fascinating newsletter. We've summarized what you really need to know. That's The Occult Hierarchy Part 2. And if you don't take the newsletter, shame on you. But if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927 or better. Go up on the internet under RadioLiberty.com and pull down our June newsletter. It will certainly alter the way you look at the world. That's The Occult Hierarchy Part 2. And if you doubt that the occult hierarchy that rules the world exists, you go up on the internet under Google and you type in occult hierarchy. And as you scroll down the page, you'll see the references to the various theosophical websites, and the Theosophical Society will tell you about the plan with a capital P, because that deifies the plan. And of course, it is a Satan's plan to rule the world with the help of his followers. There is another dimension out there, and of course, many of these leaders have tapped into that. If you'd like a copy of the attendees at the latest State of the World Forum meetings, or one of the recent ones, where you'll see former presidents of the United States and the rulers of the whole world there, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. As for the Gorbachev State of the World Forum list, and then of course, get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Get the some of the various things that we offer, books like Lucifer's Children. Get the material, various videos we have on the Iraq, the Untold Story, and, of course, the syllabus that explains why we are in Iraq. It has nothing to do with oil, really. It has nothing to do with protecting Israel. It has nothing to do with protecting our dollar. Let me suggest Iraq, the Untold Story, the video, the syllabus, and you'll see the documentation, and you'll realize that the Japanese have been trying to surrender at the end of the Second World War for 5 or 6 months, and we wouldn't let them surrender in the invasion of Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were unnecessary. And I know this to be true. There's an article in there from the Chicago Tribune in April of 1945, but General Albert Wedemeyer told me exactly the same thing when I'd interviewed him before he passed away. But you see, we can't let the American people know that we killed all those people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki unnecessarily. You cannot understand that there really is organized evil in the world, and many times it's working at the highest levels of our government. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders, our ministers, but we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And so, until tomorrow evening, when we'll be with you once again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.